I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business. 750's on a roll. They're in California, they're in Colorado, they're in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, offering wholesale pricing data and a searchable format to buyers in those states. We spoke with one, Jordan Salcido. Hello.
Hello.
Of the Momofuku Group, had a few things to say about her use of the 750 service.
I just want to say thank you to 750 for making my life about 1,000 times easier than it ever was before. Instead of dealing with lots and lots of stacks of printed books, usually of several of which are out of date, I have access to all of that information with the click of a button. You've made my life a lot easier. You've saved me a countless number of hours in the brief amount of time, I would say 6 months, that I've been fortunate to work with you. Thanks so much.
750, saving so many hours, saving rainforest paper. Thank you very much, Jordan Salcido of the Momofuku Group, a 750 user. Nick Mills of Ripon on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks, Livy. Really good.
Nice to have you here.
Yeah, good to be here.
So your winery is in central Otago in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And how did it get started as a winery? What was the backstory?
How does it get started as a winery? Well, first, it's a piece of land. Ripon itself is not so much a brand as actually a place. It's a very unique piece of land that was bought by my great-grandfather in 1912. So, yeah, we've been on the land for 100 years last year and 4 generations on the farm. The third generation of those farmers was my father, Rolf, and he started experimenting with Vitis vinifera in the early 70s and then planted the first commercial block in 1982. So that's really the beginning of it, but that was sort of the continuation of a long association of our family with that piece of land.
So your father planted the vines, and where did he come from, and what was the story with your dad?
he grew up as a young boy in New Zealand, in the South Island of New Zealand, obviously, and there was two things. There was firstly, our family, at the time, we were warehousing soft goods really into New Zealand and in Dunedin, which was the largest port town in the time. And so he grew up in that family, but he was sort of looked after or cared for by his grandparents, my great grandfather and grandmother, for one reason or another. That's how it happened. And they had wine on the table, which was quite rare. He was born in 1923, so he grew up in the 30s. Prohibition, we had that as well, and certainly depression. And so for a young man to be growing up at that time with wine on the table was very, very unique. The other part of the family story is the farm, is Wanaka Station, what became Ripon. He grew up there, farming there, and looking at the piece of land and trying to understand what its potential was for any type of agriculture, viticulture, just trying to understand the land and have a look at it. And it's a beautiful piece of land. He used to sit on the hill there as a young lad and come up with ideas with how he might farm it. Not so unique for his generation. He went off to the war. He was in the submarines in the Atlantic in the Second World War, and like all of his peers, straight out of school, really. And after that, he came back, so legend has it, via Portugal, and saw that there was schist in the Douro Valley, saw the schist that the vines were planted in, and said, you know, that's kind of like our land. And I think that's where really it first sparked the idea of viticulture. He had wine, and he had grown up with wine, and then he saw where it was growing, and he put two and two together. And I think that's really was the sort of genesis of the dream, at least. When he came back to New Zealand, he wasn't able to come straight back to the family farm for one reason or another. He was sort of ushered into the family business of warehousing in Dunedin, and then ran a number of different warehouses in New Zealand, and had his first family. He married Mara, his first wife, and had 3 kids with her. She passed away around about the same time as the family company, Sargod Son & Nguyen, was absorbed, or at least disbanded. And out of that, he got a golden handshake, and that prompted the sort of allowed him to be able to come back to the family farm. He married my mother. She was 46. No, he was 46, and she was 21 when they got married. So pretty cool, I think, for both of them. And they came back and built the family homestead and started up our family and started, that was in the early 70s, and started experimenting with the sniffer straight away as soon as they moved back onto the family farm.
And where did he plant when he planted?
Planted everything he could find. You have to imagine that back in those days, the viticultural model of New Zealand was very much based on probably Australasian sort of cultivars, and certainly the Dalmatians had been doing a lot of work, the Croatians and Brekoviches, Corbins, I'm sure I'm missing out a number of them there, but you know, all up around sort of Auckland, Hawke's Bay, Gisborne was really the I think this where the New Zealand wine industry began. And so looking that far south, even into the South Island, let alone down into Central Otago, was something really quite different, certainly, but quite a long reach in terms of imagining or understanding what might be able to grow. And so most people told him that nothing would work, which really just gave him the impetus to plant everything he could find. He planted all of the planting stock that was available. We had about 25 different varieties to start with. And from that original stock, we were taking cuttings, and I can say we, because it was our school holiday job when we were kids, was to take the cuttings off the best cultivars, the best vines, the ones that were performing the best, that's to say growing and issuing the most balanced fruit, and then planting them through our own nurseries, and then planting out parcel by parcel over about 15, 20 years it took us to plant out the whole vineyard, but slowly narrowing down to the 6 varieties that we have today.
What are those varieties today?
So we have, out of the 15 hectares, we have about 14.8 hectares of grapes. What's that, like 30 acres or something?
Yeah, 35.
35 maybe. Acres, yeah. So just over half of that is in Pinot Noir. Lots and lots of different planting material, lots of different clones, all Vitis vinifera directly into the ground.
So they're not grafted.
So they're not grafted, no.
Which would be unusual for a lot of people. It's very unusual.
Yeah, back in those days, in the pioneering days, for us, it's not so unusual. But now, certainly, obviously, Phylloxera is in Central Otago. Where we are, we're quite isolated in our own right, in our own valley, and we don't use any contract crews or machinery. It's all we do all of our work ourselves on the property. So really the only risk is someone coming in and bringing it in on their feet, I guess. But so we have protocols for that as well. But then we have Riesling. We have about 2.5 hectares of Riesling, just a little bit less of Gewürztraminer, a tiny little bit of Gamay. We also make Sauvignon Blanc and Osteiner as well. Osteiner is a little German hybrid that we have. So all of those varieties, particularly the first four, let's say Pinot Noir, Riesling, Gewürz, and Gamay, are there really in function of the fact that they are really perfectly suited to that site after many, many years of empirical observation and understanding. And I say perfect, whatever that means. What I really mean to say is that we don't need to adjust the must anymore. We don't need to use acid, sugar, water, yeast, vitamins, nutrients. We can just issue the fruit, and it's balanced enough to be able to issue that into wine without having to adjust it.
And the wine seemed quite good to me. I mean, I've had some good experiences.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we like them. Mainly though, it's a product of our land, and it was land first. It wasn't like we were, let's say, sitting in a restaurant somewhere, overlooking a vineyard, and being inspired to become wine growers, and coming down to Central Otago and buying up hectares of land, and then, you know, planting into it because the real estate agent and the viticulture consultant told us that would be the place to plant it. And no, it's a piece of land that is, as I say, a unique piece of land. We see it as an individual. We approach it as a unique and a unique individual, and that's how we farm it. It's really just trying to do justice to that piece of land and allow that to have an expression through the products that it produces. It just so happens that over the years we've found that Vitis vinifera, and particularly some very noble varieties, fortunately for us, are able to prosper there and to grow and to produce more issue balanced fruit.
So you're in Central Otago, and where are you in Central Otago, and what is that place like?
Central Otago is a very beautiful place. It's not just beautiful for the eye, the human eye, but the landforms that you see and that are attractive to the eye are actually very attractive to growing Vitis vinifera as well. It sits on the 45th parallel, so We're right on the other side of a very large chain of mountains called the Southern Alps of New Zealand. And we have a westerly airstream that goes around the bottom of the planet called the Roaring Forties. And it only hits landmass twice, so South America and New Zealand. And so it goes across vast expanses of ocean and picks up a huge amount of velocity. It brings in systems from spring equinox, they come in from the sort of more tropic sides or sort of north of us, and then in the autumn equinox they starts drawing in air masses from underneath us towards from Antarctica, and mixes them all together and drives them around and around the planet. When it comes around underneath Australia, it's often heavily laden with moisture and hits these 10,000 foot peaks straight out of the ocean and drops all of its rain. It's about 5 to 10 meters of rain falls on the other side of the ridge from us every year. That's to say 20 to 30 feet. It's one of the wettest places in the planet over there. And then we have a very strong rain shadow happening from there on. And we're right behind it, right behind the mountains, and then extending further down the valley, that it gets hotter and colder and drier the further you get away, the more powerful that rain shadow becomes. Central Otago itself, Central Otago proper, sits like Alexandra, that would be, sits right in the very hottest and coldest and driest part of New Zealand. New Zealand's only continental climate, really, viticulturally speaking, because of that. Everything else is maritime. But where we are in Wanaka, and where Ripon is, we're right up underneath that divide. So we're the closest proximity to the main divide, which means we're not quite as hot, not quite as cold, not quite as dry. We're the most temperate microclimate of Central Otago, but softer. And obviously being next to a big lake, a large thermal mass, that's to say it only changes 2 degrees from summer to winter, it cools the hot days down and warms the cold nights up. So it's another sort of temperance device, if you like, and so it's a very soft environment, which means that we don't have a huge amount of flesh in our wines. We don't have a lot of mass. Everything's a little bit more precise, perhaps detailed. Elegant, if you like. It's not a word I would use myself, but it's just a little bit more highline and articulate, perhaps.
So that's the climate.
Yeah.
How does it work with the growing? How do you farm?
Basically, for me, it's about trying to allow the vine to be communicative of its place in its soils. So that's obviously issued to us from the ancients, from the Cistercians and the Benedictines before them, and we have been influenced by that. Everyone that grows Pinot Noir, I think, is influenced in that by that in some way. It's this notion of having a certain deference to the land trying to understand the land, create a relationship through the land. Certainly from the Cistercian side of things, it was even more developed than that from a religious side, to the more that we expressed or reflected our surroundings in our work, let's to say our architecture, our food, our wine, the more we glorified God, the closer we got to God's creations or glorifying God. I think those creations, for me at least, I just call nature, and the spirit and the sight itself. Trying to issue that into something that we can taste and feel.
Do you spell it nature with a dash where one of the vowels would be?
How's that?
I'm just kidding. It's a little bit of an obscure kind of Jewish joke.
Yeah, all right.
You may not have many Jews.
So. I'm married to one.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't get the joke, sorry.
Oh, that's fine. Actually, that's how it usually goes.
Okay.
It's knock, knock, who's there? I don't get the joke, is most of the jokes I tell.
Yes, right, okay.
So in terms of glorifying nature, what does that mean for you in terms of a practical method?
It's trying to farm in such a way that the vine, the individual, is tied to the land. So we understand from nature, we take from biology, that a plant can't metabolize minerals directly out of the soil. That's not how it evolved. It evolved 1.8 billion years after the first microflora came onto the planet. And when you cogitate that for a second, it's quite a remarkable idea, is that the largest biomass on the planet that still exists is all of the microflora of our soils and our land. They were there for almost 2 billion years before the first roots of the plant roots came down into the land. So the plants weren't trying to metabolize those minerals directly out of the soil. They were getting the nutrition from the soluble exudates or the byproducts of the microflora of the soil. And so if we are trying to, if our craft is to try and get the vine to be communicative of our source, our true craft is to know, understand and work that that microflora, that life and that medium that allows that the soil and the rock to be translated into plant matter. So that's how, that's the sort of overall thing. How we do that is clearly no irrigation, it's biodynamic farming, it's patience. It's trying to allow the vine to is not to force it so much. If we have young vines that haven't got their roots down, don't try and don't over extract them and get out unknowable phenolic material. Just allow them to be young vine wines and then work and start waiting and just have that patience to wait until you get to 15, 20, 30 year old vines, and then you can start extracting, you can start pulling out, you can start making, you know, issuing more robust wines from that, at least phenolically speaking. I don't mean robust as in, you know, tannat or anything, but just in terms of looking for the tannins, the true matter of the seed, if you like, that's not highly developed in a young vine.
And it seems like that would manifest itself in terms of the different bottlings that you make, because you use different fruit into different bottlings. And what are those for Pinot, and how do you distinguish?
Yeah, Pinot, we have four different Pinot Noir. So we have the Ripon, which is all of the mature vines off the whole property. We call it the Ripon. Ripon is, as I said before, it's a place. So it's a lieu dit in its own right. So Ripon is our sort of flagship, if you like. It's who we are. It represents our farm. It's also what we make most of as well. We take the young vines out of that picture. So everything under sort of 15-year-old vines, 15... these aren't really communicative of their place yet. So we just, as I said, issue that, no new oak, just all very, very light handling. So that's our two principal wines. After that, we have two other smaller Clément, if you like, much more precise sites that we can show off as well, which is Emma's Block and Tinkersfield.
And what are those like?
Emma's Block is probably our most unique. I'm going to use the Burgundian word Clément. It just it expresses the site a lot better in terms of. It is its own unique exposition, its own soil. It has, though it's all planted on schist, we haven't talked a lot about that yet, but it's schist, it's all precision and detail and compaction.
Like your dad's saw in Portugal.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's a metamorphic rock. So Tinkersfield is pure schist gravel, so very precise and detailed and compacted in its phenolics, whereas the Emma's Block has a little bit of clay running laterally through it, so ancient clay bed, the ancient lake bed, clay lenses, these little sort of sausages of clay that run through the schist gravels, and this gives the wine a little bit more sleekness, a little bit more mobility in its phenolic makeup and the mouthfeel at the end of the palate.
What's it like to work with schist?
Well, it's magic. I mean, I learnt my craft on clay limestone complex and a little bit of granite up in Alsace as well, but it's coming back and working with schist. It's an amazing. It's beautiful. It's got a huge amount of light refractivity. So the light gets into it and then refracts out in lots of different ways. So in terms of how that is expressed into wine, is again all about precision, detail, a sort of layered effect to the phenolics as well. How is it to work with it? I don't know, but I have this feeling that when you look at Vitis vinifera and where it evolved on the sort of eastern Anatolia and the Transcaucasia, Georgia, Armenia, eastern Turkey, all of that sort of where Vitis vinifera was sort of evolved is really hard, rocky escarpment slopes, essentially. And so these are very fine and articulate root hairs that can get into that stuff.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so you can you compare that to, say, American rootstock, which is, you know, the muddy banks of the Mississippi, where, you know, you've got a very thick root mass that can go straight through clay soils, riverside riparian margins, if you like. This is a much fatter root here. Obviously, it coexisted with certain parasites, phylloxera being one of them. That parasite didn't really want to kill its host. It just put its proboscis in. Of course, it scars when it takes it out, and the sap can still get through. Whereas if you do that on Vitis vinifera, the proboscis goes in, it scars the root here, and the sap can't get through, and the vine perishes. So it's quite a different anatomy of root hairs that are that take purchase or find purchase in our soils. And schist needs that. It's very foliated and leafy and compressed in its makeup. And so you need very fine root hairs. We don't need, but it's advantageous, let's say, to have very fine root hairs that can actually get into that stuff.
What you're saying is Phylloxera is intending to kill part of what it needs for its symbiotic relationship of life. It's trying to live with the host, but with these different kinds of root hairs that are not what it grew up with, it ends up killing them because they're a little bit smaller.
So, to my understanding, that's how I was taught, what I was taught. Yeah, absolutely.
It's like angel hair pasta as opposed to...
Possibly, yeah. Well, when you think about it, parasites, they don't want to kill their host. I think that's called something else, actually. A true parasite lives on its host and feeds off its host, but it doesn't actually kill it. It's not its goal, if you like.
Because you have non-grafted vines, you have these angel hair roots going down into a particular kind of soil that you find that advantageous because it's working with this schist that you're talking about.
Oh yeah, you can imagine when we dig a hole in the property and we go down maybe 3 or 4 meters into the rock, and you can take out a piece of rock like a flat like a plate-sized piece of rock, and you'll pull it out. On the top, there's just dust. There's no life on the top. You can just blow the soil straight off the top of it. And on the bottom, there's this big sort of wad of microflora of organic matter, essentially, sitting on the bottom of it because water percolates through because they laid flat. Because the rocks are flat, it can't wick back out. The water can't be wicked back out. So all the life sits on the bottom. And that's where all the root hairs have found themselves. They're all, in symbiosis with the microflora of our soil as well. They're excreting, they have a relationship with that. So what happens next is that wherever there's water, there's life. Water is life. We're talking about bacteria, protozoa, fungi, nematodes. These are organisms that are 99% water, essentially, with a thin carbonaceous shell around them. They are essentially water, as we are, as all life is. And so wherever there's water, there's life. And so this water might seep into one of these cracks in the schist and get in there. And of course, if you've been farming properly, if you're putting out fungal-based compost onto your land, that will be transformed eventually or very quickly, perhaps, into life. And so then the roots, obviously, are going to follow that in because they're getting their nutrition off the soluble exudates of that medium. And then you try and take one of these rocks after like 20, 30 years, you're trying to take one of these rocks out of that soil profile, that wall that you're standing in because you're standing in a hole, essentially. You try and pull that out of the ground, and it's just got this big sort of web of root hairs that are holding onto it, and you can see that they're all just completely infiltrated and taken over the rock. And that's where you can start talking about dewa. You know, you can't, if you're working in such a way that you're feeding with irrigation and putting soluble fertilizers on the surface, this interaction will never happen. So it's a long and it's a process that takes a long time. It takes a lot of work. It's manual labor mostly, making compost and hand hoeing to keep the weeds down. But obviously without irrigation, it needs patience to get there.
Because
but eventually,
the roots need to go further down to find the moisture.
Absolutely. Well, the moisture is actually that life. We don't really look at water holding capacity in the vines or in the soils as the liquid that you and I think of as water. We see it as life. We just try and bind all of that water up into life so then the vines can feed off it.
What were some of the influences for you in developing where you're at philosophically? I mean, you're working biodynamically now. It was organic from the start. When your dad planted, you guys use mesol selection vines from your own nursery.
Mm-hmm.
It's, as you mentioned, not grafted, which is unusual for the world. Usually things are grafted onto American rootstock. What was your own route to find the wine that you ended up developing this philosophy?
Well, I grew up in the vines, obviously. I had certain mentors. My father clearly. But he was just my dad, you know. He's just your dad.
So you ignored whatever he had
exactly,
to say.
You know,
that guy's full of it. Turn on the TV.
Totally. Well, that's it. You know, I mean, it's only until you become a man yourself and you look back at and you realize just what a cool thing he was doing. But at the time, it was just what he was doing, you know. And it's okay, so that's what your dad does. And it was my mother as well. She created the business, whereas Rolf just sort of had the vision and worked in the vines. The first person in my life that sort of gave me some indication that it might be a cool craft was actually Rudy Bauer, who was it was great to have him at a tasting that we did that we put on here in New York yesterday. He was a young Austrian guy that had just come out of school, essentially, or he had actually done some, probably the first really experienced and qualified winemaker that came into Central Otago, and he made some of the wines that that we from the early 90s, 91, 92, and 1990.
He worked at Ripon.
And so I was working in the vines with him, and he was sufficiently, let's say, eccentric and sort of philosophically minded, which we communicated well in the vines when I was as a late teenager. But then when I left school, I had got sort of bitten by the sort of Olympic glory bug, and I tried to get to the Olympics in 98 in Nagano for freestyle skiing, and just about got there. I was number one seed in the country and New Zealand champion for a wee while, and then blew my knee about 5 months before Nagano, and so that was the end of that dream, and that really was the impetus for me to redirected me back towards wine. And we used to live in France when I was seven, when my parents were learning their craft, and so I had French somewhere I went to primary school over there for a year, had it somewhere in the back of my head. I used to dream in it, which was quite weird.
Used to dream in French?
Yeah, but without...
Did it involve a lot of cheese?
Yeah, exactly. I had all these people would come up and offer me things and talk to me in French in my dreams, and I'd wake up and have I'd talk to them, but I'd have no idea what I said when I woke up. It was quite strange. And that was for like 18 years before I eventually went back there. When I went back, I didn't really know anyone. I found the CFPPR, the school in Bourne, the technical institute there, and ended up going to school there and worked in Burgundy for 4 years, worked and lived in Burgundy for 4 years for a number of different very special domains. In terms of mentors while I was there, probably the first is really Alain-Sophie Meunier from Jean-Jacques Conferon. I spent a year there, and that's where I did all my stages. Nicolas Portel and perhaps Pascal Marchand. Benjamin Leroux, good friend, not so much a mentor, just a party buddy. Then I was finishing off these vintages up in Alsace as well at Domaine Albertman. So the Barthelme brothers, Jackie and Maurice, were huge influences in terms of how I approached the craft. And at this stage, I'd already been started to be exposed to, let's say, a certain way of working. Obviously, I grew up on an organic farm, but, you know, from Napoleonic inheritance laws, when you've got 10 different ways of working in the same vineyard, it's quite special to be able to see that and to understand it and to see how people work. So I came in from a really empirical side in terms of going, okay, if you walk into a vineyard and you see this guy works in one way and the other one, you go into the vines and you see the soils, you smell the soils, you taste the fruit, you feel the environment that's in there in terms of the insects and all the life that's happening. You taste the fruit, you ask if you can come and taste, if you're interested enough, you go and taste in the winery, in the cellar, and you see the person's is passionate and they love their craft and attached to their land, and you see that... the wine is very articulate and speaks very clearly of its place, and you see the staff are happy and the wine is selling in the marketplace, and you're just like, what? You know, you start to make an idea about how you might want to work. So it came from a very empirical side of things. While I was, I got the opportunity to work 8 months at the Mandela Homini Conti at the same time as they were starting to convert into biodynamics as well. And so I worked under a guy called Philippe Fontaine there that was developing the biodynamic program. And I think it was he that encouraged me to do a course with the GGPV, the Young Wine Growers Association, essentially, of Burgundy, with Pierre Masson, who's a biodynamic practitioner there in the Mâconnais. And we, with Jeremy Sass and Hubert de Monti and a bunch of other wine growers, we all did this course together and traveled around northern France and into Germany and just saw literally dozens of different, how people worked on different farms it just became clear that that was the way I needed. I wanted to farm, so as soon as I came home, obviously Aubert was a big influence in all of that as well. But more just from a, not so much from a land based sort of aspect, but more just the humility, it's so tied into the Burgundian DNA anyway, this idea of that Cistercian, what we were talking about before, of just having a piece of land and trying to issue a product and using the grape as a sort of a medium or a vector to be able to express our sight into something that we can taste and feel. And so that was about it. So as soon as I came home in 2003, something was really special was that I didn't really feel like I needed to turn up and go, all right, these are my goals. I've just been working at these special places, whatever, you know, this is how we're going to do it kind of thing. It was quite the opposite. I'd been encouraged by everything I'd learned over there was to stand back from the land, or at least begin again this relationship with the land that I'd had as a kid, but try and enhance that and try and get the culture and the whole of the team and all of our team to be able to be part of that. And so we're not, no one has any titles. We're all polyvalent in the way we work, and just try and understand the land, try and stand back from the land and ask what it wants as well, and just try and issue a product that's of that land rather than actually stamping on it and go, okay, this is what I have in my head as a human. This is what I want to see. This is the sort of wines that I like. Is just actually invite the land to speak to you itself.
So you got back in 2003 to Ripon, and that's also about the time that the move towards biodynamic farming started.
It was right then. Yeah, we changed straight away. Like, came home, made the first compost. We were making compost before, but made the first biodynamic compost and applied those first preparations. And really just, there's more of a cultural shift, I think, as I say, in terms of having a polyvalent team that everyone can do everything kind of thing. That was probably the biggest shift that happened.
So your dad planted the vines in 75. Yeah. What is that? How old all of them are, or
no,
are there different ages involved?
Yeah, absolutely. 1975 was when the first experimental vines and the first, what we call the first commercial block, went in 1982. But most of the planting, certainly of the Pinot Noir, planted between 86 and 91. That was the bulk of the plantings. But we were planting, even when I came home in 2003, I still had some rationalization to do, if I use that word, for the idea that we still had some varieties that, although they were performing from some years, that we had still had Syrah, we still had Merlot, we still had Chardonnay, pull those out, plant with Riesling, Pinot, or Gewurz, essentially, and just narrow, keep honing it down. And so that was still happening. My father passed away in 2000, so he saw the vineyard. No, he didn't actually even see it fully planted in terms of the area, but he certainly didn't see it fully replanted, you know, certain parts of it fully replanted. And it was actually a bit of a sadness, really, to see that in 2005, I think, when I did the final plantings, essentially, to Rolf had already been gone 5 years by that stage, and so he didn't really see that. He also... he missed one other thing too, which was I found my mother crying in the office one day around about the same time, and she'd just had two export partners pay the bill in the same month, and for the first time in 25, 30 years we went into the black. So, and Rolf didn't get to see that. It was a bit of a shame. He didn't get to see yesterday. Yesterday was a really special day for us, being able to show 20 different vintages of our Pinot Noir here to people in New York. I think that was a really, really special time. And when you've been working for that long and actually being able to issue a snapshot of our history, essentially our story, in one go like that, I sort of had to represent my father in my own way.
And you talked about having the patience to watch and wait for vines to gain the maturity that they need in terms of vine age. How do they express themselves over time? How have they expressed themselves over time in that climat? When do you start to really find what you're looking for? At what age?
Yeah, I don't think there's any one age. There's different sites and different cultivars grow and express themselves in different ways at different times. I think I can really relate it almost to human years in some respects, is that if you ask a 5-year-old what its expression of its surroundings are, it might take a piece of paper, or you give it a piece of paper and some crayons, and it'll draw, you know, mum, dad, and the kids kind of thing with a very vibrant and endearing image, a way that they're doing it. And the image itself might be colorful and as I say, vibrant, but it won't have a lot of detail yet. It won't have a lot of, it won't be very articulate either. It'll just be something that you should cherish. And if the parents aren't being too overbearing, let's say not pushing it around too much, it can just stay exactly what as that. You can put it in a nice big thick book and put it in the library, and hopefully 20 years later when you take that book out and have a look at it, it'll present very much the same sort of picture, but it won't have developed or changed over the years. So that's what we see from our young vine wines that are now 20 years old, 20 or 20 plus years old. And I actually see that when you, I got to taste many wines at La Romanée Conti. It was a privileged time in turn, because they had, whenever their customers would come through or the export partners, they would taste wines and have, you know, fond de bouteille, like a little bit of wine left in the bottle, and I was able to take those home and have them with my spaghetti bolognese or whatever I was cooking in our little apartment. And one of the ones that really struck me was the 1952 Richebourg, which is very much in that sort of same idea. It's the one that Henri Loire wanted at his funeral. It's this really vibrant, beautiful, endearing wine, but it doesn't yet have a lot of, I guess, complexity, and it hasn't really changed. You can see that the phenolics haven't been breaking down and developing into new stuff. It's very precise and beautiful at the same time. So that would be say 5, 10, maybe 15 years. Once we get into the teens, we get into a little more difficult time, just as in humans. You know, 1 year it'll tell you one thing, the next year it'll tell you to, you know, bugger off, it wants to, you know, watch TV instead. Or Rudy Bauer, I said that same sort of thing to the Masters of Wine in London once, and we were co-presenting. Rudy said, no, it's got nothing to do with the fact that the vines are being recalcitrant, or, you know, that they're going through their 10 years. It's more about the parents are being too overbearing. And it's true, you know, once you've got, it happened for us, once you have this vibrancy of youth and fruit, and you've issued that into a wine, you get really excited, and then you want to push a little bit harder, and you might even start putting some new oak on there and stuff and start pushing it a bit. And these wines become very inconsistent. They don't last in time either. So that would be the sort of teenage years, but by the time you get to the 20s, now you start coming out of that. You can't come into this idea where you actually get some in vine age, 25, sort of certainly into the 30 years. Now you're getting into some articulation, some creativity as well, in the sense of being able to articulate very well a certain site, and you get wines. When I'm talking about wines in terms of articulation, it's about detail. It's being able to not just have one voice, but have many voices, lots and lots of articulate pieces to that phenolic matter, to that those tannins, and to the shape and the feel of the wine. So that happens in the 30s, and then I think by the time you get into the 40s and 50s, fertility starts coming down a little bit. The vines, you know, doesn't express quite as much. But what it is saying, it needs to be listened to. This is where perhaps wisdom comes in as well. And when I'd say wisdom, using it in that analogy, would be exactly, you have these long phenolic chains, tannins, essentially, that over time in the bottle will break down and develop into different things that weren't previously there. So every time you go back to it, unlike the child's crayon drawing, every time it's like the book itself, you come back to it and read a page, it's sort of something else occurs to you, something else that you didn't see there before. I think that's sort of, and obviously vines will carry on, so 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, humans are starting to, you know, perhaps lose their teeth and stuff. They don't have a lot to say, but what they do say, you sit down and you listen. Clearly vines will outstrip it, and they'll keep going on and on for past human years, but that, for me, is how I kind of understand it. Obviously, I think Riesling's a little bit, that's Pinot Noir. Riesling's a little bit more of an intelligent or a gifted kid. It picks up that detail a little bit early, maybe 12, 13, 14 years old. We're already starting to get shifts being shown in the phenolic makeup of the wine.
Well, so you worked with Aubert at DRC.
Yeah.
And they have well-known choices involving oak use and stems, mm-hmm. and the way that they ferment, mm-hmm. in terms of mallow. Mm-hmm. What are the choices that you've decided to make with the fruit that comes into your winery?
Yeah, I'm led by digestibility. By wine for me needs to be olfactory. You know, have an olfactory stimulus, but mainly it needs to have a digestive one, a tactile one, and a digestive one. So. just to outline that a little bit, I'd say that fruit has two different purposes, really, in the way that we look at it. It's the first is the skin and the color and the flesh, therefore the flavor, the sugar, therefore the alcohol, therefore all the high-end ketones and esters and all the stuff that's up in your face when you're drinking wine. All of that's the attraction factor for the bird to come along and eat the grape. This is a really important part of the grape, but for me, the truth of the grape is in the seed. It's the genetic matter that the vine has produced, has taken all of the, say, information, let's call it, off its land, and is issuing it into its prospective progeny, into its offspring, essentially, so it can be successful in that same environment. You can't taste or smell a seed or the dry matter of the skin, which we'll be talking about in whites. So what you're doing is you're looking at a texture and a feel, a shape and a form. And to issue that, it needs to be digestible. It needs to be something that you can chew and actually take into your body. So that's what we're led by. We're led by this idea of trying to throw energy into the seed and develop the texture of the wine, the shape and form. We know this from the classical models. The difference between a Vendée and a Pommard is not cherries and plums or something like that. It's a shape and a feel. It's a form of the wine. So we're led by that. In terms of how that relates to where I was working in France and the people that I work with and how that may have influenced me, I developed my own ideas after working at places that were using a lot of whole clusters or new oak and what have you, and just tried to think of something, wine being vinous and tonic and wanting the body wanting to take it in. So when I look at vin, vinegar, vinous, it all comes from stretches from the idea that wine is something that's probably closer to vinegar than it is to fruit. And so really looking at trying to look at the development of our wines as a part of a death cycle, essentially. Like if you look at anabolic, and this is a Jacques Lardier sort of analogy, you've got the life cycle coming out of the ground and being issued all the way through into the grape, and at its summit it'll be the seed. It'll be ready to propagate germinate or to send its seed to another place. This is the summit of that anabolic, that life cycle. At that point, the fruit drops off, or you cut it off, and from that point, it'll go through primary fermentation, malolactic, acetobacter, all the way to vinegar. That's a catabolic cycle. That's death cycle going down or slant, if you like. Our craft is to try and develop that and at some point arrest it on its, let's say, death slide and issue it cleanly as possible into a inert recipient, a bottle, and present it for sale and consumption.
A pardon of some sort.
Yeah, yeah, that's
an
right.
Executive
yeah.
pardon
exactly.
of the winemakers.
Exactly, exactly.
Before death.
Yeah, and that's our choice. Where we create that, where we give it that pardon, essentially. In the new world, for many times, in the ways how wines have been qualified, how they've been written about, how we want to make them, how we want to make them. Is really right up next to the fruit. It's Gewürztraminer, Fremina, Sauvignon Blanc. These are things that you generally have just, for me, indigestible in the sense that it's all been created for the olfactory senses and not for the next part. Where the further you get down that line into, let's say, natural wines or wherever, the further you get away, closer to get vinegar, the more saliva runs in your mouth, the more that your body actually wants to take it in, for me. So if we look at that and we think about that in terms of how we approach our craft and in terms of what we're going to put into the wine as well. Stems, for example, to use your example, our vineyard's massively parcelated just because of the way we planted. We've got lots and lots of different parcels of different plant material. And so we micro-ferment all of those. They come up, we pick them all more or less at the same time, but they come across, we know when they're coming across the sorting table, and we will put the first few bins of it through the destemmer and then taste the stems at the end. And if I can get some saliva and we pass them around and we can get some, and it feels like that wants to come into the body, that's to say, it'll tell you straight away that it doesn't. Your body will eject it, it'll spit it straight out if it's too astringent. But if it can be, then put them all in. If they are digestible, put them all in, because it's a better from my point of view, it's a better fermentation, intracellular fermentation, better pathways for the yeast to run around. It presses out far better. You don't have to do so many turnings. Technically, it's just a better way of fermenting.
Kind of amazing how bitter and better are the same word for you.
Yeah.
In terms of the wine that you make.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the problem is some of them taste like crap, you know. Some of them are indigestible phenolic. So I don't see it because, Dujac or like does it, or La Romanée Conti or whatever. It's like I want to put a stylistic statement by putting 15% whole clusters in my wine. That's ridiculous. If 15% of shit phenolics is not going to help your wine, and it's not, you're probably going to have to fine it, or if you don't, it'll never break down, and that'll appear like 20 years later. It'll still be sitting there when everything else is breaking down around it. So... looking at it as something being led by that digestibility, led by the human, how we get in, that's what we're led by. So we make decisions based on that. Whole clusters, for example, we're between sort of 25 to 40% whole cluster across the Pinot Noir. But we're also led by that in terms of Riesling and whites, in terms of how we ferment. So that's to say we will... press whole bunch press, put it in a tank, don't strip it so we don't find the juice, it's full cloudy juice, and then ferment it in a lay flat fermenter, a fermenter that's on its side, so it's got like a stainless steel foudre essentially. It's like got a huge amount of lees to wine ratio. It doesn't have any capping, so we don't push through CO2 or nitrogen or argon or anything like that. It's still got oxygen in contact with it. It doesn't have any nutrients, vitamins, adjustments, acid, water, sugar, yeast, doesn't need anything. It sits in that and will start fermenting naturally. It doesn't have any heating or cooling, so it does go through a temperature spike, which means that you might lose some of those high-end aromatics and stuff, those attraction factors. Okay, hopefully not too many. Certainly in our environment, those things are a given anyway. But what it does do is solubilize all of those phenolics in the bottom, in the barrel of the fermenter, into the wine itself. And then it sits on its primary lees. This is Riesling or Gewürz we're talking about. It sits on its primary lees for months, for the whole winter sometimes, unsulfured, just in contact with its nutrition, in contact with its lees, and solubilizing that phenolic matter into the wine. So we get a wine that's perhaps more precise and digestible, essentially. That's pushing it further and further down that line towards death, let's call it, you know. Yeah.
And you make Pinot Noir, you make Riesling, you make Gewürz, but you also said you make Gamay. And what's the difference between growing Pinot and growing Gamay, and what's the difference in the expression that you find?
Between Pinot and Gamay, in terms of how we grow it and how we approach it, there's very little difference. They both need, in our environment, vertical shoot positioning. They both need a lot of care. In terms of how we approach it in the winery, more or less the same, how we receive it in the winery. But of course, Gamay, our Gamay Noir, at least some of our Gamay we make into a rosé, a proper rosé. So that's one, not a Seigneur. It's macerated for until it starts fermenting. It'll stop, drop probably 3 or 4 bricks and be completely red juice. But when we press it off, but then a lot of that color drops out in the ferment once we press it off and finish it off in tank. We make a little bit of a rosé like that. But the main thing that we do with it with our Gamay is make a Noir, Gamay Noir, and that is. It starts off carbonic, so we're harvesting the CO2 from the Gewürz fermenters. They come in around the same, or come in sufficiently early that we have some fermenting juice in the winery. So we harvest the CO2 from that and just put it in the bottom of the tank into a pipe essentially that goes into the bottom of the fermenter of the Gamay, and starts off the Gamay unsulfured no adjustments, 100% whole cluster in a carbonic environment. We'll do a little bit of foot pigeage on that and open it up to do pigeage maybe only 3 or 4 times during its primary fermentation. And then we press it off. It'll finish off its last couple of bricks in tank. So it starts off carbonic, but it finishes with some oxygen contact. But last 3 years, we've been able to run that into bottle. It tracks more or less the same as the Pinot Noir. Some years it goes through mallow in the middle of winter. Some years it goes in the spring when the rest of the Pinots go. But then we just draw that and issue that straight into bottle without sulfur, fining, filtering, nothing. So it's completely alive and natural and a beautiful, beautiful wine.
So we talked a little bit about the climate. I noticed when we tried an 08 and an 09 Ripon Pinot Noir recently that there were some differences in the wine, and you had mentioned that 1 year was a little hotter than the other. Mm-hmm. What have the recent vintages been like, say, in the last 10 years in your area of New Zealand?
Yeah, we at Ripon, of course, it being a place, we don't buy any fruit in or sell any out, so we're unable to mediate the fruit or the, let's say, the vintage conditions by fruit from somewhere else. So we are, and even though we are a sort of semi-continental climate, we have to understand that we are just a relatively small island in a very large mass of water, in an ocean. So this means that we are subject to the vagaries of oceanic currents and weather systems and stuff like that. So our vintages do vary greatly. The important part is that the phenolic markers, what we were talking about before, the texture of the wine stays the same no matter what happens with the flesh and the color and all of those attraction factors that's sitting on top. What underpins the wine in phenolics, and we saw that yesterday, there's a line that runs cleanly all the way through those 20 years essentially. But clearly the vintage will change, and we saw that dramatically between the 2009 and 2010 yesterday in terms of color. Your 2009 was a very overcast sort of year, not a hell of a lot of light, quite cool during the growing. We finished off, Central Otago often has just beautiful conditions during the harvest, but summer can be mixed up and things can change around. But late summer, it starts to calm down and we get beautiful end of the season. But in 2009, we had a lot of cover, so it's almost like a wraith-like sort of beast. It hardly even exists almost in the glass. A very light color, but you know, still the phenolic mark, still the precision and detail in terms of the texture of the wine. 2010, same shape, perhaps a lot more matter compressed into that shape and almost opaque, like very, very dark color as well. So even physically, like visually, they're two different wines. Going backwards from there, 2008, quite a warm vintage, quite plush for us and rare for us in that sense. It still has that sort of articulate detail in the wine and that precision of the phenolics, but you have a lot more sort of flesh sitting on the top of it, if you like, because it was a warmer year. 2007, frosted and difficult flowering period in December, so very, very small yields, very compact and tight, but I thought it was looking beautiful yesterday. I think it was the standout for me. 2006, again, another warm year. 2005, a little bit more like the 07. We could go back if you like. But
well, I'd be curious to know which are real standout vintages in the history of Ripon for you, since you just did a large vertical. You're familiar with some. What are the Pinot Noirs that have really been key markers, either for, boy, I love that, or boy, I don't know about that. Yeah. What have been the realization vintages?
Well, all of them have been realization vintages in one form or other. We learn from every one of them. In terms of standouts, I have a difficulty in qualifying our vintages. One, like probably most wine growers, you know, we sort of they're our babies kind of things. We don't really have a qualification sort of rank to them. But at the same time, we could say that there are certain vintages that were special to us, mostly for cultural reasons or social reasons. Really, 2003 for me was my first vintage home, and it's a really very special year. It's like a 2001 Burgundy sort of thing, really honed down, just great year for the land to speak clearly. So it was a bit of a gift for me to come home to that in a year where it was a very neutral year, not too hot, not too cold, and just clarity of place came through very, very loudly. So you imagine that was as a first year visit, one out of the box. It was great, and that looked wonderful yesterday. So that's certainly one of them. 1992 was a really special year for us. When you go back there, 1990, 91, 92, all of those, and the 93 that we're actually drinking now, am I allowed to say that?
It's quite good.
But this is colder. You can see, in 1990 it was a warm year, and every year after that it got colder and colder. You can feel there's a bit of chill in the wine, in the makeup of this. But 92 was a special wine for us. It was the first time. It was our fourth Pinot Noir under label, and it got the gold medal at the Royal Easter Show and the trophy for New Zealand's best red wine back in the days where entering shows was important, to us at least. That was the first time a Pinot Noir ever done that in New Zealand, certainly the first wine out of Central Otago, and So Ripon, Central Otago, and Pinot Noir came on the map all at the same time at that time. So historically, a very important wine for us. The 1990 was as well in terms of just turning people's attention towards some of our very successful winemakers in Central Otago now. As whether they're at high school or university, that sort of turned their face to Central in terms of, hey, something's going on down there. And that was one of the very first wines to come out of Central, the 1990. 95, I thought, looked exceptional yesterday. That was Clotilde Chauvet. I don't have any personal attachment to it. I was at that stage, I was already skiing and doing my own thing. 2000, I think, is probably the year we first started to see maturity of phenolics coming into the wines. You know, it was coming out of its teens, we were talking about before. We're starting to get some noble phenolic matter in that, and by about 2000, and we start seeing the more texture and precision and detail in the wines. 2003, 2005, yeah, that's probably about it. 2010 kind of is a bit of a landmark for us. We were running around the winery high-fiving each other when we were sitting in the barrel. 2012 coming up, going to be bottled in a few weeks, is epoch changing. Maybe I'm not allowed to say that yet because it's still in barrel, but it seems really, really good. Yeah.
And why is that?
Because it's taken this long. It's taken this long for us to understand how to do our job and how to relate to the land. And we may have forgotten it by next year. Who knows? In 2013, I think we did a good job. But this, the culture, the way that the humans are bonded together and created a culture on our property and a relationship with the land, that's taken a long time. And so before that, we were sort of, you know, throwing darts in the dark almost, you know, but now we have a sense of confidence and feel good about our decision making processes and feel good as a team. So I think things are really good right now.
From this market perspective, when I think of New Zealand, I think of Sauvignon Blanc. Right behind that, I think of Marlborough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of Nick Mills, Central Otago doesn't make Sauvignon Blanc.
Well, I do actually, but
oh, you do? Oh, yeah, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well,
see, yeah, exactly.
In terms of Nick Mills,
yeah.
I mean, is that a difficult road for you to hoe? Is to explain exactly what you're up to, and how many people like you are there in New Zealand who are working biodynamically and talking about shape? And
yeah, there's a few, not a lot. I would say three or four that. People that yeah. I communicate, that we can communicate with on the same sort of level. When I came home in 2002, I felt hugely isolated. I'd not just learnt my craft in another language, but literally another language, but figuratively another language too. I approached and communicated about wine in a completely different way to my colleagues and peers in Central Otago, and I think that's changed and developed. Yeah, people are sort of learning. Well, the craft is changing in New Zealand as well. People are approaching it slightly differently as well. In terms of New York and Nick Mills and Ripon and our team and how our wines are approached and how they find themselves here. We've had a difficult time in New York, I have to say. We've had three false starts here. That's to say, me coming over and spending time in the market and trying to find distribution. You've had a hard time too, with lots of, you know, not so favorable things in your in your city over the last.
Oh, I thought you were talking about me. No, I was like, no. I have had a hard time.
I know what you're talking about.
For several years. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Several false starts, my friend.
Yeah, right. So we had three, and they were probably from a timing thing in terms of 9/11 and global meltdown, and that pretty much seemed to happen. This was like ground zero for that, and so we had a hard time getting into New York, and you'd imagine for a small business, family business like us, spending money in a city like this and staying here for 3 or 4 days trying to find distribution is incredibly expensive, and if you come away from it with nothing, you know you create a big hole. And that's what happened three times, actually, over the last decade. Although we have had our wines here, we've had great supporters. Roger de Gorn's had it at Chantrail, had the Riesling there a decade ago. You know, I think he was getting it in from Boston or somewhere. But and we've been present here, but just in little pockets here and there. Daniel Jonas has been a great supporter, and just in terms of a palette and bouncing ideas off and introductions and what have you. But now we've got this. This is my second trip with Wine Dogs and our distributors here. And these guys are good. These guys are Kiwis, and it feels really comfortable. It feels right. The timing's good. People are understanding. New York clearly is a place that that understands our wine, probably more so than San Francisco, I would say, in the sense that our values in New Zealand, we're used to selling wine that is. Or approaching the market as the new thing, you know, the pioneering thing, and that's what served us in the beginning. But now our values are different for Rip, and we're about, you know, permanence, longevity, legacy, wines that are you know, digestible and stuff, you know, things that aren't just about olfactory stimulus. So we've got this is more of an old world sort of market wine. Japan, we've been very, very strong there for many years. Obviously the UK. You know, these are the people that understand us. I think New York can understand this very, very easily. And the reception that I've got in the last two visits with, you know, traveling, you know, beating the feet around town with Simon and Magnus has been exactly that. It's been really, really cool, you know, to see that. And obviously we've had some people visit us in the last two or three years. We're on the radar for people coming to, well, last 10 years, but now we're very much on the radar for visiting Soms coming down, Paul Greco, Dustin Wilson, Bernie Sun, these guys that have all been to us in the last three years and seen what we do and seen the land and are now really strong supporters of it.
Nick Mills, he dreams in French, he makes wine in New Zealand. Thank you very much for being here
today. Well, that's all. Pleasure. Thanks, Debbie.
Hey everyone, we love your feedback and we'd love to see your feedback in the comments section on iTunes. I know you want to tell us what you thought about today's episode. We'll see you there.
750's on a roll. They're in California, they're in Colorado, they're in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, offering wholesale pricing data and a searchable format to buyers in those states. We spoke with one, Jordan Salcido. Hello.
Hello.
Of the Momofuku Group. Had a few things to say about her use of the 750 service.
I just want to say thank you to 750 for making my life about 1,000 times easier than it ever was before. Instead of dealing with lots and lots of stacks of printed books, usually of several of which are out of date, I have access to all of that information with the click of a button. You've made my life a lot easier. You've saved me a countless number of hours in the brief amount of time, I would say, 6 months that I've been fortunate to work with you, and thanks so much.
750, saving so many hours, saving rainforest paper. Thank you very much, Jordan Salcido of the Momofuku Group, a 750 user.
And that's this week's episode of I'll Drink to That. We release a new show every Tuesday. You can find the show on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe. Thanks for listening.